This is a special Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the Invest Talk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART. They will be played and answered on an upcoming Invest Talk podcast.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. That's how you get through and ask your question live on today's show. But before we get to the next segment, we'll answer a caller question that came in via that YouTube channel. And the comment from Ulam Spiral says, "Thanks, I'm enjoying this weekend video a lot. Do you have any views on residential real estate in the Bay Area? I'm looking to buy a house, but I'm worried there's a correction coming soon." The simple answer is yes. I would be worried about a potential drop in Bay Area real estate. It's very correlated to tech, and it was rolling pretty hard for 2023, 2024, and then they had the AI kind of resurgence that started near the end of last year and into this year. And I think that kind of held the Bay Area economy together. But if you start to see some sort of reduction in interest around big tech, and obviously I've discussed how the business of big tech is suddenly becoming very capital intensive. Does that mean less room for stock options, for employees, et cetera? I think that could be a big factor here, and that would feed into residential real estate, especially in Silicon Valley. So I think in general, you just have overvaluation across most markets in the United States. And you're entering probably 2026 will be a year where prices broadly will come down. Now, it's going to be dramatic. It's going to be 08 crash in housing. No, it's just a multi-year correction. And I think it's already started, and it's just going to be a slow slog, not a lot of transactions and modest declines for a number of years in most markets, including the Bay Area. Let's pivot back to an InvestTalk voicemail question right now.
Hey, Justin and Luke. This is Frank from Los Angeles. I have a question about portfolio management. I'm having a hard time figuring out the right allocation across equity, treasuries, and corporate bonds, especially given the current macro environment. I was thinking about allocating 50% to treasury bond ETFs and the rest to just to value stocks, but I'm starting to think that I should probably allocate also something to corporate bonds, especially given how sticky inflation is. I'm 35 years old, and I consider myself a value-oriented investor. Especially in this environment, I don't think it makes sense to take much risk. Given this, what would be the ideal split across asset classes for somebody my age? Thank you very much, and I'll be listening on the show.
Well, the fact that you're in your 30s, that's a far too conservative portfolio, 50% in bonds, maybe even more in corporates. For the number one, for cash-like holdings, I'm okay with treasuries. Short-term treasuries, we use that as a cash alternative. But as a longer-term investment, no, you don't want to be in treasuries, especially any long-duration treasuries, 10 years, 30 years, et cetera. So your bond, main bond exposure should be in corporates. Now, it shouldn't be a large percentage of your portfolio, especially if you're an aggressive investor. It should be probably sub 20% of your overall portfolio. The rest should be equities. And I would lean on the value side of the market. And you're starting to see that side start to outperform once again. So hopefully that gave you a little perspective, and feel free to schedule a portfolio review with me. Let's tackle another YouTube comment question. LexusDude59 says, regarding Bitcoin as the canary in the coal mine, your thoughts? Yeah, you know, if you look at the correlation of Bitcoin and what it tends to correlate to, it's mainly a liquidity proxy along with a proxy for tech stocks. And this is very simple. It's viewed as kind of a fringe asset to the traditional financial system. And it's furthest away from your consumer staples, dividend paying safe stocks or bonds, for example, right? Doesn't pay a dividend, and its use cases are very minimal outside of mainly speculation. So when liquidity starts to dry up, well, these are the places where capital is pulled out from first. And so that's why it tends to languish and tend to be correlated with liquidity. And then there's a lot of retail investors that their portfolios are filled with the names we just talked about, right? Drone companies and profitless tech names, or, you know, very expensive, highly shorted names by hedge funds, etc. And when things are going well, they can handle a little leverage. They probably own some Bitcoin as well. Those are the Bitcoin holders. They get excited and they invest in the sexy things. And so when the NASDAQ goes down, are forced to de-lever their portfolios, de-risk their portfolios, and Bitcoin often takes it from there as well. So once again, it's mostly about liquidity. And the fact that this is struggling right around this level, around, what are we at now? Currently, Bitcoin's at 106,000. And frankly, it's right at that support level that we saw, mid-October? And if we break 100,000, those are the June lows, and psychological level of, you know, breaking 100,000 is, I think, a death knell to Bitcoin overall. At least in this cycle, I think we're headed for a rough 2026. I think 2027 is probably the buy point at some point, where you get a capitulation of negative sentiment. But I certainly think there's a good chance we've topped in this Bitcoin cycle, and the charts are certainly lining up for that. So that's why I say it's a canary in the coal mine to broader financial assets in general. And it's one of the pieces of evidence that I talked about on my YouTube video over the weekend that tells me this market is running on fumes. Typically, Bitcoin peaks first, and it looked like it did back at the beginning of October.
You are listening to an Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. When you tell your friends about InvestTalk and they ask you why you listen, let them know there are many reasons, and one is parallel investing from KPP Financial and InvestTalk host Justin Klein. Parallel investing means Justin invests right alongside KPP Financial clients. He makes the same trade for KPP Financial on the same day, at the same price, and the same percentages as KPP clients. There's no front running and no special treatment. In this way, Justin and KPP Financial share the same risks and the same potential for success. Parallel investing aligns the interests of Justin and KPP Financial with those of his clients. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero are ready to answer your questions about parallel investing. And you can learn more anytime at investtalk.com.
This is a special Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the Invest Talk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART.
I was just reaching out to see if I could get your thoughts and opinions on the three bucket strategy in retirement, what you think about it and how it relates, you know, to market downturns and sequence of return risk, and to see if it's a good strategy when you are approaching that time in your life. I'll be listening. Thanks.
Now, the three bucket retirement strategy is a way to it's a way to smooth withdrawals, right? So you take your assets and you segregate them into three different buckets. What is your short-term needs, right? Your cash, your money market, your T-bills, your short-term bonds. And that helps fund your living expenses. It helps you avoid selling your investments during your downturn. Second bucket is your medium-term income, your intermediate bonds, your dividend stocks, your CDs. And it's designed to replenish bucket one and provide stability as well as regular income. Then there's bucket three, your long-term growth. 10 years plus, your equities, your REITs, your alternatives. It's a big growth engine to help you outpace inflation and refill buckets one and two over time. Now, like I said, this helps to smooth withdrawals. It helps to reduce a lot of sequencing risk, and it helps to give some psychological comfort. It matches your investment horizons to your spending needs. I think this is a great way to go about constructing your financial life. It is one of many tools that can be very helpful, and certainly, for a lot of people, I would recommend it. Thanks for the call.
Hey, Justin and Luke. Love your show. I have a question for you guys about where you think CD rates are headed over the next 4 years. I need to lock some money up, and I'm wondering if I should lock it up at the current four-year rate or if I should go shorter and then renew down the line. Any help with this would be great. Thank you.
Well, remember, the market prices in, including the CD market, it prices in Fed rate cuts and where what yield you're going to get. So it's less about is the Fed going to cut, and it's more about what the market is priced in for a Fed cut and whether that's real or not. For example, if you go out, I'll go out to October of 2027, the median outcome here is somewhere between right about 3%. We'll call it 3% is where the market is expecting Fed fund rates to go. Now, the current effective funds rate is 3.88%. So we're going to call it four rate cuts between now and in 2027. Now, is that going to be true? And remember, it has to stay there because that's where it's expected to end at that rate, right? You could see them cutting rates and then raising rates, then dropping rates again or whatever, right? But over 4 years, or in this case, to 2027, okay, nearly, it's called 2 years out, I would expect rates to fall and then go back up. Because I expect a rate hiking cycle at some time between now and the end of 2027. So it's really going to be about the yield curve and how it moves. Now, would I go 4 years? Probably not. I would probably go somewhere in the year to 18 month level so that you're able to refinance or reinvest, shall we say, and get liquidity. You're not missing out on a whole lot. You're not going to pick up a lot more yield, I don't think, from a four-year CD versus a 18-month CD or a two-year CD, okay? And that's the way I would be thinking about it, is how much are you willing to give up for that liquidity? I'd be willing to give up a decent amount of yield to get that. Yeah, I'd really want to know what that rate is before I would truly commit. But I would probably only lock it up for 18 months to 2 years.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about H&E Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers.
If you're willing to take the risk.
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk.
With host and financial advisor Justin Klein.
And that volatility. Go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager, Luke Guerrero.
This company has fallen like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THC.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Justin and Luke. This is Matt in Miami. I'm just calling in regards to a question about taxes. I recently realized this past year that I overpaid my taxes considerably and have recently changed my holding from the W-4 to be exempt. To stop taking out taxes. But it's made me realize that in the past, maybe I've been giving the government an interest-free loan by getting a tax refund every year. So I was thinking about changing my future tax allocation for the next year to be exempt and just keeping that money in a high-yield savings account. I'm a pretty disciplined investor, so I wouldn't be worried about spending it or not having enough money to pay off my taxes at the end of the year. I'm married, but I file separately from my wife, and I don't have any kids. Look forward to hearing your thoughts on the podcast, if there's any pros or cons to this. Thank you.
Something I think a lot of people have thought about over the years, and I think the answer is there's a balance here. I think you're trying to go completely the other way. You paid too much, and you gave the government an interest-free loan, and you don't want to do that. But you also don't want to pay nothing and then get penalized, because the IRS will penalize you if you're not paying a reasonable amount towards what you probably owe. So I think a CPA, I'm not a CPA, but I do know that. And it's something that you should probably speak to a tax advisor about and to make a final decision. but I always try to make it so it's I don't have a huge refund or owe a lot. Because when you owe a lot, once again, I've been penalized where I underpaid and do my quarterlies, things like that. And I was penalized because I paid my taxes, just I paid them kind of at the end, and the IRS doesn't like that. So make sure that you find a balance. I wouldn't go exempt. I'd probably still claim one or two and get it to a point where you're not giving it them an interest-free loan, as well as you're not getting penalized. Thanks for the call.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Let's take a live call. Jarek from Halifax, Canada, wants to talk about oil field service companies.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to talk about oil field services, just with everything that's going on in Venezuela. On Monday at market open, I took some small positions in Halliburton, SLB, Baker Hughes, and Weatherford. I'm just wondering if any of those names stand out for you, and or if it's kind of too early to say whether these companies would see some tailwinds for kind of rebuilding the oil infrastructure in Latin America.
I think it's far too soon to really tell. And frankly, I think the assumption that this is going to A, go smoothly, and B, that these companies are going to willingly put in billions of dollars to improve extraction volumes in Venezuela, I think both of those are assumed way too much. How much will there be unrest in Venezuela over time because of this? History of our regime change operations globally usually creates problems in that country. And then, you know, there's a reason why these big oil names have not invested heavily, because of obviously policies there, but certainly a big part of it too is the instability and the fact that these are kind of like oil sands. They're very similar to Canadian oil, where it's very heavy. It's also very expensive to get out of the ground. And so the break-even rates for a lot of these projects aren't low. You know, what a lot of these oil companies really love are your traditional oil wells, not your oil sands, not your shale oil. They would love to just these easy ones that bring crude easily to the surface. You don't have to crack rock. You don't have to do a bunch of things. And the break-even levels are a lot lower on those type of projects. These are very expensive. And you add on, the geopolitical risk. To say that they're going to start spending billions on extraction, I think is way, way overblown. So I think the move in these names is not correct. I would not be trying to chase these names, especially after this move.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's keep things moving and tackle another listener question from 888-99-CHART.
Hey, InvestTalk. This is Kevin calling from Southern California. Today I have kind of a strange retirement question. It's theoretical. If you had like a $10 million IRA and you wanted to do a full account Roth conversion, are there any states where it would be worth moving to for a year and making that your primary residence to do this full Roth conversion, where you save enough on taxes, state taxes, where this might be worth it? Just always have retirement thoughts on my mind. I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Great question. And the simple answer is, yeah, there are many states. I believe there's 7 or 8 states that are completely tax-free. Now, you have to establish residency. If you're coming from California, they scrutinize you pretty good to make sure that you really are moving. You're not kind of skirting the rules. Now, if you're a lower income earner, they're probably not going to chase you. But if you're a high income earner, they probably will. So you have to be careful with that. Also, remember, if you convert your entire account, that's going to hit your adjusted gross income on the federal level, no matter where you live. And so most likely, and for most people, very few people, especially if they have a large IRA, they're not going to do a conversion all in 1 year. Remember, you don't have to do that. It's not like you have to convert every dollar from an IRA to a Roth if you're going to do a Roth conversion. You can just do a little bit each year. And frankly, for the vast majority of people, there's a certain amount that keeps them below the next tax bracket for them to do that conversion each year. And slowly over time, they convert most, if not all, of their IRA to a Roth. And I think that's a goal everybody should have. And creating a plan is very important, whether you do that, whether you talk to an advisor like me to help with that, whatever it is, everyone should have an idea of when they're going to convert their IRA to a Roth IRA or 401k to a Roth IRA, et cetera. So I like what you're thinking of, but this is more, this would have to be more of a longer term plan. Hey, I'm going to move to Nevada, state tax free. I'm going to live there for 5 years. I'm going to break it up over 5 years, and I'm going to lock in a lower tax rate, both on a state level and a federal level, et cetera. And then maybe you can move on from there. But make sure that you consult with a licensed tax attorney or CPA before you do something like this. And make sure you build a bigger picture plan. So many people are myopic and they just focus on one particular aspect of financial planning without looking at the big picture. For us, our clients, we use Orion. There are a lot of different options out there. From eMoney to, you know, other planning softwares. I think everybody should run through that to understand from a tax perspective, a strategy perspective, model out the cash flows, both income and expenses, and assets and liabilities. All of this should be modeled out, not just a snapshot of today, but going out into the future decades. And that is when you can make informed decisions about when you should do things like Roth conversions. So hopefully that gave you some perspective on how to think. And once again, make sure you aren't myopic and just saying, I want to focus on just Roth conversions. No, it's part of the bigger picture.
This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Are you tired of wasting money on supplements that might not work? You can end that foolish game with True Diagnostic. The truth is that your body is unique, and what works for someone else or an influencer might not work for you. That's why True Diagnostic is valuable. It measures over 1 million biomarkers to tell you exactly what your body needs at that moment. There's no guesswork. It is not generic advice. The True Diagnostic True Age Test is a simple, at-home, finger-prick test that gives you real, data-driven insights into your health and aging. The digital results provide the precise data that enables creation of personalized, actionable steps that you can take to improve health, boost energy, and slow aging. You follow the three recommendations for 90 days, and then retest to see progress. The True Age Test is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals. I found what I needed firsthand when I took the True Age Test from True Diagnostic, and it completely changed the way I think about my health. Right now, InvestTalk listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code INVEST20 at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code INVEST20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
This is a special InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the InvestTalk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Duncan from New York. Thank you for all that you do. I'm trying to do the best I can to learn a little bit on how to short a stock. I'm looking at stock ticker Vera, V-E-R-A, Vera Therapeutics. The way that I'm looking to learn how to short a stock is the following. I am using three sources of research: FinViz, the stock screener, Fidelity.com to actually look at the specifics of the stock, and I'm also using Gemini that actually helps me explain certain terminology. But for the stock screener, I'm looking just for a mid-cap, short float over 10%, a relative volume over 1. I'm also looking for fundamentals of a PS ratio of over 5, return on equity negative, a debt to equity over like 0.1, and return on invested capital, negative 1. And in terms of just the technical analysis, I'm looking for a relative strength index of like very high, overbought. Just looking to see what you guys think and what are some other fundamentals or technical signs that I should be basically looking for a float. I hope I did, you know, the right research or use the right resources. So thank you very much and have a good night. Bye.
Well, I'm glad you're utilizing a lot of resources that are out there. The problem is understanding how to apply some of these concepts. So I'll give you the two biggest flaws in the way you are looking for a short candidate. Number one is you're looking for a company that has a high short interest. And while that can give you a sense of how many other people are also betting against it, it also, at least in the short term, creates a lot of risk of a short squeeze. Because you're not the only one out there that are going to be forced to buy it if it continues to rally. And so having high short interest is fuel for a short squeeze. And a lot of times people can't handle that volatility. When you're short and it goes up, that's volatility. That's effectively like a stock going down if you own it, right? So actually want low short interest. You want to find names that other people aren't really paying attention to. Now, I like the fact that you're looking at a biotech name, you're looking at a name with negative return on equity, return on assets, burning capital, et cetera, trading at high price to sales, meaning it's overvalued. But in the biotech space, it's all about a story and whether the story is gaining momentum or not. And so I'm not sure about this particular technology that they utilize or not, but I wouldn't be jumping on this, especially when that last part, which is, you talked about relative strength, very high. And very high relative strength can mean it's overbought, but that doesn't mean you want to short it. Overbought just means that it probably needs to be cool off a little bit. It needs to consolidate before that next leg higher. It tells you nothing about whether it's going to go down and roll over anytime soon. Stocks that overbought tend to stay overbought, tend to be in an uptrend and stay in an uptrend. The trend is your friend. What you want to do actually is wait till the stock is in a downtrend. That's a much better stock to short. Why? Because the market is recognizing the problems with their business. And whether a stock goes from 100 to zero or $10 to zero, if you short the same dollar amount, you're making the same amount of money. It's irrelevant what the stock is trading for, as long as it continues to go down. But in your case, you're looking at a stock that's going up. And this is Vera Therapeutics. Relative strength is 94. It's in an uptrend. It's right near a 52-week high. I don't want to be jumping in front of this, even though you're right. You know, it's a story stock. I don't like those names. I don't want to invest in those names. But momentum is momentum. And you have to respect that. There's a saying in the shorting industry, shall we say, which is don't try to wrestle the jaguar out of the tree. Wait till it's out of the tree. You're not going to wrestle it out of the tree. So wait for this to roll over. You want to be looking at names that have terrible relative strength and that people are losing faith in the business altogether and that it's headed for a zero. So that's ultimately what you want when you're shorting a stock. So look for names with high debt more than anything. I would want to short a name with high debt versus high price to sales, high valuation, etc. I want a lot of debt. I want a crappy business. I want it in a downtrend. Those are the names that you want short.
InvestTalk is ready 24/7 for your finance and investment questions.
I'm hoping you'll give me your take on Ormat Technologies, ORA.
Is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, my name is Joe from Greenville, South Carolina. I have a question that's a little bit more macro. Just as our currency as a country has gotten into this fiat currency with no real backing, it seems like the Fed and the government, when they don't feel like they can raise taxes, just print the money, which is ultimately devaluing our currency over time. And there doesn't seem to be any indication that they're going to stop doing that. They are likely going to do that more and more into the future. What do you think a good safe haven for that would be in the long term? I'm in my 30s and just, I guess, somewhat worried about a somewhat bigger collapse of the system, just the value of the dollar in general. Is stocks a good place to be in the event of something like that happening? Is gold and silver a good place to be in the event of something like that happening? Is land a good thing to be in the event of something like that happening? I'm just trying to figure out a plan, I guess, for something like that were to happen, because it seems like our currency is just devalued year after year, and I just don't see any change in that coming. Thanks so much. Listen for your answer on the podcast.
This is the winner of best question of 2025, because this is the framing every single investor out there should be thinking about. Not, I'm just going to index, right? That's not the new world. The new world is this, what this caller just asked about. Yes, absolutely. The politicians on both sides of the aisle, and you can see it right now, right? Trump ran on Doge and cutting spending. He cut like $7 billion, $9 billion, nothing. It was, you know, so nothing stops this train. You're right. So you have to think about it differently. Now, is gold and silver part of it? Yes, absolutely. Everybody, I've been saying this for years now because I've seen this. You know, you can talk about, oh, how you want the world to be. And I talk about this all the time. Never invest how you want the world to be. You have to invest based on how the world is. And you're identifying it, that this is a train that does not stop and will not stop. And so you have to adjust your portfolio accordingly. So number one, yes, gold and silver. Number two, harder assets. Are stocks a good place? They tend to be a good place to invest. Now, harder assets tend to do better in inflationary environments. And those can be companies that hold and own harder assets. They tend to not be growthier type of businesses either. They tend to be more value-oriented. That's how it tends to work. Now, depends on the year, and it's not a straight line, but this is the new era that you are operating in. Now, you typically don't want to be in treasuries, super low-risk investments. You know, most people are still scarred by 08. Everyone fights the last war. Remember the generals fight the last war? Most people are fighting 08 because that's the real big war. Yeah, we had COVID and all that, but still that's fresh in a lot of people's mind, even though it's nearly two decades ago. It shows you that the risk in this market is not deflation. That's what 08 was, the deflationary impulse. We are seeing that the risk is to the upside, which is inflation, an inflationary impulse. And remember, markets are not priced in real terms, meaning subtracting out inflation, they're priced nominally. So I think it was from 1962 to 1982. Equity markets are up, but in real terms, your return was zero because you subtracted out inflation and you kept up with purchasing power. And so I think there's probably a period over the next 20, 30 years, an extended period where you're going to see that, where if you're just investing in the S&P, your real return is going to be zero, maybe even negative. So yes, you have to rethink your portfolio strategy. That's what we do for our clients at KPP. And that's what we really speak about and adjust our portfolios accordingly. Hope that helps. There's a lot more. I could go in depth, probably hours for this. Now let's pivot back to the InvestTalk Voice Bank for a call that came in earlier from Maine.
Hi, this is Andrew from Maine. And I had a question for Justin. He often talks about the importance of liquidity in the macroeconomic view when it comes to short to medium term broad market performance, particularly on risk assets. And I'm wondering what measures or metrics you look at to monitor liquidity in the macro view. I'll listen for your answer on the podcast. Thank you.
Great question. And if you watch my video, I pretty much do every single weekend on our YouTube channel, I answer these questions. What's going on with liquidity? What's going on with the markers of a healthy or not healthy market? So there are some that are kind of liquidity proxies. Bitcoin is a good example of that. That tends to be the outskirts of the financial system. And when that tends to weaken, well, that means liquidity is generally getting tighter. It's where money kind of flows out of to plug the holes, let's say we say, in TradFi, right, in that industry. So certainly Bitcoin is one aspect there. Another, which is underappreciated, is commercial bank lending. And this is right now probably the best indicator of decent liquidity. A lot of others are actually looking worse, and I'll talk about those in a second. But if you look at the growth in bank credit, it was consolidating at about 4.5% year over year for most of the summer and into the fall. And now it's accelerated now up to 5.36% year over year. So remember, when banks are lending, they're creating dollars. Commercial banks are the ones that create the most dollars in the system, hands down, bar none. It's not the Fed. It's not the Treasury. It's commercial banks. So they're lending more. It's more dollars in the system. That's more liquidity. When they're lending less, the opposite happens. So that's number one. And that is the best sign for risk assets right now. Then you look at things like the Treasury General Account. And this has been rising pretty rapidly recently. And this has been a big draw on liquidity really since August, where the Treasury General Account went from about $300 billion to a high recently around $957 billion. And the target by year end is $850 billion. So they could draw that down. But when this rises, that is money being pulled out of the system. Those are dollars being pulled out of the financial system and onto the Treasury's balance sheet. So those are a few examples. Now I can go on and on, talk about a lot on my Saturday video. So I encourage you to tune in there. But those are a few examples of things that I follow to see, is liquidity good? Is it bad? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? On the margins, it's getting a little bit worse. Once again, see that in Bitcoin. Now, is it dire? No, there's shade, everything shades of gray. A lot of people, that's probably the hardest thing for the average person to get their head around, is that the world is not black and white. Especially when you look at, look at our politics, right? You're left or you're right. Well, the reality is most people are kind of in the middle. And the reality is that in the markets, there's shades of gray. Sometimes it gets a little better. Sometimes it gets a little worse. Sometimes, yes, things are really bad, but those are few and far between. Sometimes things are really good, few and far between. There's nuance here. And so following the data helps give you that nuance, at least give me the nuance. And that's what I tend to unpack on weekends. Hope that helped.
Let's keep things rolling and answer another caller question now.
Hi, I'm calling from San Bernardino, California. I'm wondering what it means to monetize the debt. And is that something I can use? Thank you.
Okie doke. What does monetizing the debt mean? Because I think that's something that we have mentioned on this show often, right? Government monetizes its debt when it finances it by having its central bank essentially create money to buy government bonds, effectively turning debt into newly created money. What it can do over time is it can keep interest rates lower, it can make funding a bit easier, but overuse risks two things: inflation as well as currency weakness. Now, can you monetize your debt? Well, if you are issuing debt and printing money, then you're probably breaking the law. You're definitely breaking the law. So the answer is no. Only governments with a central bank like the US Treasury, Federal Reserve, can monetize their debt. So if you find yourself in a position where debt is becoming a burden, think less about monetization, which you can't do, and think more about managing it smartly, which you should.
InvestTalk is ready 24/7 for your finance and investment questions.
My 5-year-old son and I listen to your podcast every night, so thank you very much for putting it on.
Justin Klein is here and ready to tackle your questions.
Is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
Wondering what you thought about this REIT, if it would be a good time to get in.
I wanted to pick your brain about Apple. What did you think about their earnings call? Is this a good time to add to my position?
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go talk to David in New Hampshire. Wants to talk about international exposure.
I'd like to add
some more international exposure to my portfolio. I have some emerging markets already, so I'm looking at developed markets. And my question is, should I purchase an ETF that includes Canada? Or is that essentially, like, are those companies going to track very closely to what's going on in the United States?
No, I think that there's no reason to exclude Canada. Businesses are very different. Just think of what are the large domestic corporations you're talking about, heavily tech, versus Canada is going to be more oil, utilities, industrials, banks, telecom, companies like that. I'm just thinking of the regular Canadian companies that I encounter. Mining companies, you'll get exposure to those as well, natural resource names. And some of those sectors I really like natural resources, and as I was talking about earlier, natural gas, but others not so much. So you're definitely getting more diversity. You're getting access to some very quality names, especially gold and silver, things like that. So I see no reason to exclude Canada because it's definitely going to give you different exposure than you're going to get domestically. Thanks for the call.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Good evening, InvestTalk. When writing options, I've found a few companies that have been successful for me month after month, at least for the past year now. And my question is about capital gains. If I choose to roll those options into the next month, and then after that, and then the next for over a year, and then finally close out of those positions, would those be considered long-term or short-term capital gains? You know, since I've rolled them for over a year, I'll listen on the podcast. And thanks as always. Take care. Bye.
They would be short-term capital gains. Doesn't matter if you're rolling it. Each option technically is its own trade, even though it might be in the same position. But the features of those options, expiration, strike price, etc., they're all different. And that means each one has its own CUSIP, has its own code that makes them different. And so you're not holding something for over a year. So it's definitely going to be short-term capital gains. That's one of the drawbacks there of selling options. That's why I like to sell options in tax-deferred accounts. I'm going to. And that helps bring in income to the portfolio without the tax implications, because it's all about when you take that money out, then you will pay tax. But in the meantime, that's why we like covered call strategies, especially in IRAs, Roth IRAs. That tends to be a good place for a covered call strategy. So good question. But remember, those are all separate positions.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is Mark calling from Santa Cruz. First of all, thank you for the daily addiction of InvestTalk. I've been totally hooked for years. I have a question. If you could explain, please, a little bit about what covered call ETFs are, how they work. Are they cyclical? Would you recommend them for retirees to help out with additional income? Again, thank you guys very much for all that you do, and I'm looking forward to your answer. Thank you.
This is a great question. I love this because this is a hot space. And most of the time, when the retail investor gets excited about new products that's pitched by Wall Street, they're duped in many ways. Not to say they're duped in that they're going to lose money, but they really don't understand what they're buying because, you know, these fund companies in Wall Street, they're good at spinning the narrative, spinning the story. I think the SEC needs to change the way that these are really classified and the way that the marketing is done. Unfortunately, the SEC, they've been asleep at the wheel for a long time now. But the simple answer is it's fool's gold. You're not getting the yield that it says you're getting. Because what's happening here is they're running cover call strategy. A lot of time we're doing on an index, and that's, it's a simple process. Like, we run a cover call strategy, and I don't have anything against a covered call strategy in general. What I do have a problem with is that is anyone saying a covered call strategy is giving huge yield. Now, we talk to our clients and we say it's bringing in income, but it's countered with giving up potential upside. And that's what most investors are not understanding here, is that yes, you're bringing in extra income, and it, in down markets, it definitely hedges against the downside. In ho-hum markets, you can do much better than the broader indices because you're bringing in income, and those that are buying the call options are losing out and you're gaining. But when things are doing really well, it can hold back returns. So it's really more of a, what I call a vol dampener. It lowers the volatility of the underlying investment. And the underlying investment is whatever that is. It could be the NASDAQ 100, the S&P, could be a mix of stocks, whatever that is. What you don't want to do is think that, oh, it says it's getting some big yield. For example, one that we benchmark a lot of our strategy to is the JEPI, the JP Morgan Equity Premium Income Fund. And it will say that the SEC yield is 7.25%, trailing 12-month yield is 8%. And the reality is that's not really true. If you go look at the total return, that's what you want to do with these names. Do not pay any attention at all to what the quote-unquote yield is. It is functionally irrelevant for these names. What you want to focus on is the performance. What is the total return that you are getting from these names? And JEPI this year is up 7.25%. So effectively, its year-to-date return is somewhere around what its quote-unquote SEC yield is. Maybe slightly higher if you're annualizing. Right? So, you know, you're getting that yield, but you're also subject to the downside of the markets as well. It's a can hedge, but that's about it. It's a ball dampener. That's it. So when you're looking at these covered call ETFs, whatever that is, there's a lot of them out there. I don't want to dig into each one. Understand, ignore the yield, focus on the total return. If you're comfortable with the total return, you're comfortable with that lower volatility, that you're have a little bit less on the upside, as well as maybe potentially a lot less on the downside, then it might be right for you. But don't think of it as this surefire yield producer.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.